the first refugee ever elected to Congress.
The machinery of democracy should work for everyone everywhere, not just in certain places and not just on a certain day.
Power sees nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. We still have to be willing to show up every single day and demand our seat at the table.
So f***ing proud of you guys.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 227. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. Andrew and I were just working on my class action lawsuit against the concept of fire that I'm going to be filing. Is that he'll tell me if that's something I can actually do. How's it going, Andrew?
It's going okay. As we were just talking about off the air, I was going to complain that I have landed in the United States, and instead of being in the most beautiful place on earth, I have come home to snow, which is delightful. And then, as you pointed out, is it snowing fire where you are?
Yeah.
So
at least it's snow plus oxygen, right? Because I don't have that anymore. I'm over here doing the Spaceballs, opening the cans of air and breathing them in to be able to even do the show. It is. I'm looking at the air map, and they had to invent new color. It looks like a kid's coloring project gone wrong. Like they just did all the wrong crayons for all the colors, and you still have to be like, oh yeah, really good. It looks like that. The air quality scale, it doesn't even have a number for what the next color that's about to take over Sacramento is. So this is awful. But how's everybody else? Hey, I'm not in the fire. I know a lot of people who who were displaced by it, actually, and it's a total hellscape. No, all joking aside, it's really awful. And yeah. While I've been suffering through over a week of smoke and not being able to take Phoebe outside, could be worse. Could always be worse.
Yeah, and no, I have in the Southern California fires, and we're gonna actually have a segment about the fires, in our C segment. But
will it be called? What's the song? Oh, we didn't start the fire. Will it be called?
God,
is that an 80s thing?
Yeah,
I was trying to make a reference that would go for you, but I realized
it's a good one. That's a Billy Joel novelty song from I think either 1989 or 1990. So it's okay. That qualifies, I think, as it is a quintessentially 80s song.
Reference? Yeah,
yeah, yes, my people do in fact recognize that reference.
But yeah, we are going to talk. I'm interested to hear what you have to say about. We're going to talk a little liability and stuff in terms of what happens with these wildfires and figuring out who's responsible. We also need to talk. Ooh, I love this. This is fun. We pretty much do this every time now where we got an Andrew was right and an Andrew was wrong in the same segment. And I think that there's a lot of good stuff. We got a blue wave to talk about. We got Federalist Society Group. Oh, I'm curious how you're wrong or right about that. And we've got Jeff Flake's legislation that I'm curious. I saw your Twitter take that was actually a good sign, and I have no idea what you're talking about. So I'm very curious to hear that. And we've got a lawsuit in Maryland. We've got all kinds of good stuff. Oh, Maryland is suing Whitaker, rather. I should specify. That's a really interesting one. Wow. Andrew, this sounds like a lot. Are you sure we're going to have time for all this? But this is all good.
I feel pretty confident. What this means is that we will need to talk about Michael Avenatti's arrest and the and this is really, really important. It needs its own B segment. The lawsuit brought by CNN's Jim Acosta regarding the revocation of his press credentials. We will do those stories next week. So we're going to do those on Tuesday. There is a pending motion for a preliminary injunction. I think that is likely still to be live when Tuesday comes around, and I want to go through those stories in detail. We can't do that and everything that happened this week, and you know, and we always say that the world is on fire. Your world literally is on fire. So gotta prioritize. We'll shunt those to next week and hopefully walk everyone through really, really interesting litigation. But we've got super interesting litigation this week, so I can't wait to get to it.
All right, enough preambling. Let's what are we the Declaration of Independence over here? Let's get to the point.
All right.
Ms. Vito, please answer the question. Does the defense's case hold water?
No.
Andrew
is wrong.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
It was a blue wave. Yeah, I want to say I was I'll go first. I was slightly wrong. I wouldn't say I was, because in my episode I said a blue wave was met by a red wall, which I actually think is still accurate. I was just so surprised with how many people voted. I mean, record-breaking turnout that I just would have assumed. If you'd asked me that or told me that, you know, 6 months ago, I would have thought, oh, well, that means Democrats just sweep everything, because there's no way the right is going to be like motivated to turn out in record numbers. But I mean, they kind of were too. So that's my take. What were you wrong about or right about?
So I feel like this chalks up under the Andrew was right column. Our buddy Ben Young the third sent us this. I'm going to link the 538 article in the show notes, in which they have sort of summarized after a couple of days and after the dust settled, you know, yes, it was a blue wave. And this is a really, really good 538 take. There are a couple of points that I want to highlight that I think are really consistent with what we said in our post-election. So number one is the degree of the swing, right, yeah, which went from Republican plus 1.1 in 2016 to what looks like, once the California numbers all come in, it's going to be Democrat plus 7 to 7.5. So that's an 8.5 to a 9-point swing. That's huge. It's the third largest swing in history, both by percentage and also in terms of picking up votes. And I think our buddy Nate Silver and the folks over at 538 made, I think, two really good narrative points, right, that sort of explain the kind of initial take that you know, you and I certainly both had election night, and I think came through in your blue wave meets red wall, right? And the first is that our really high profile candidates sort of all look like they came up a little short, right? I mean, we've talked about Georgia. That's still going on. But it looks like Stacey Abrams is going to come up short. We know Beto came up short. You know, that has an emotional impact.
And yeah, and Scott winning. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and certainly Andrew Gillum, we've talked about him a lot on the show. So I think that's a good point. The second point he makes is the distinction between and this, I think, is related to our gerrymandering argument, that the blue wave here, as Nate Silver points out, the tipping point district in the House of Representatives in this election was an R plus 8 district. Right.
Wow. Yeah.
Again, we know what Red Map is designed to do. It's designed to produce districts that are in that range, R plus 8, R plus 9, when you are slicing up a state like North Carolina and making a bunch of safe Republican seats and one or two, you know, totally overloaded Democratic seats. The tipping point state in the Senate was R plus 16. And, you know, and Nate's argument is that the blue wave was enough to overcome R plus 8. And it wasn't enough to overcome, you know, a double digit 15, 16, 17 point heavily Republican states. And I think that's a really, really good way of looking at it. You know,
and it goes to show how much our framing, even, you know, even you and I, who, you know, you've covered the gerrymandering really well on the show a ton. Even still, it's hard to not make that be part of your like background framing, you know, like, oh, if all the Democrats do is go plus five, you know, and then it's a tie in the House, then all of a sudden it feels like a failure when really, I mean, I'm glad we didn't do that. I'm glad we overcame that. But had we only won the popular vote by what is really in all like objective framing, a landslide, which is like 5-6%, and gerrymandering just takes that away, just makes it so it doesn't matter. We all would have felt incredibly disappointed. And it's hard not to have that be part of your framing, where it's like, not only do we have to do well, we have to do well and overcome these institutional kind of cheating barriers that Republicans put in place.
Yep. And I want to tease a future show. There is a really, really interesting, I mentioned North Carolina. There is a really interesting lawsuit pending in North Carolina regarding the gerrymandering of that state's constitutional districts. And again, kind of following the OA playbook, I hope that these folks are listening to the show. Otherwise, you know, I'm just really, really prescient. It's a state lawsuit. Right. And I think that is going to be the future. Right. We've talked about, you know, the Supreme Court is lost and may stay lost for decades and may be, you know, a bastion of right wing conservative activism. There are ways around that. And I really, really want to talk about that lawsuit. I'm going to, I promise. You know, chalk it up in the Andrew was right category, because that, I think, is the future of where our efforts to combat gerrymandering and again, left and right are going to be headed. But you are absolutely correct that the background conditions are such that if the Democrats had won by 3 or 4 points, not only would they have failed to retake the House, but they would have lost 2 to 4 more seats in the Senate. Right. Yeah. It would have been spun as overwhelming victory for Donald Trump.
Yeah. Even though you know, more of us will have voted by right. a significant percentage. No, nope, doesn't matter. Yep. Victory. It's tough. You can't help it, because the end result just... It's kind of a human bias, but, you know, when in a 50.1 to 49.9 election, which we have a few of those right now, the right. winner is 100% everything and the loser is nothing. Like, it's hard how it works that way. But, you know, yeah. I wanted to, along these lines, I saw something on Twitter and I just wanted to clarify a very quick point, because you and I had mentioned on the last episode that recounts don't often change anything. And I saw some Twitter back and forth about, oh, the lead is being cut to whatever in Florida. And I just want to emphasize, yes, counting uncounted ballots certainly changes elections. Right. That wasn't when we were saying recounts don't usually change anything. That doesn't mean don't count all the remaining ballot. That's a whole different thing. Definitely count all the ballots. And they're outstanding. There are mail-in ballots. There's all kinds of ballots that I definitely, you know, you want to count all those. And that could swing things. But our point last week was that recounts usually don't, because they just you know, kind of retally the spreadsheet there. But that's all. Cause so I did see a few interactions where it seemed like someone was trying to say we were wrong because the uncounted votes were changing things. And that's not what we were saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Couldn't have put it any better. So I won't.
What's this Federal Society group that I'm curious what you were either right or wrong about on this.
Yeah. So this is a tweet from our buddy at Me and Totoro on Twitter, who points out the founding of a new conservative legal group called Checks and Balances, which is a breakaway group from the Federalist Society. It was started by longtime Federalist Society member, ex-chair and husband of Kellyanne Conway, George Conway. And the point of the Checks and Balances group is to form a group consistent with conservative legal principles that claims that Donald Trump has exceeded his constitutional authority in a number of ways. And I feel like this falls on the Andrew was right side of the ledger, because I've been trying to urge patience as we ascend Yodel Mountain, and I have claimed that, you know, we're not in a situation where, you know, just sort of everybody on the right side of the aisle is, you know, Augustus Gloob loose in the candy and ice cream store after midnight, that, you know, that there are consequences, there are rules, there is still stuff left. And this is a group of pretty prominent lawyers with whom I disagree over just about everything, right? Like, I mean, that these are not folks that I consider allies in any way. I mean, they're longstanding members of the Federalist Society, right? And there are some prominent names on the list, right? Former Pennsylvania governor and secretary of Homeland Security, Tom Ridge, George Conway, Orrin Kerr, Paul Rosen, Swag, Jonathan Adler, John Bellinger III. I mean, these, I we don't have time in this segment to sort of get through their bona fides, but these are real conservative heavy hitters in some way. And to time this announcement on the same day as the Federalist Society's annual meeting is absolutely meant as a message. And so, you know, now the there is, of course, the flip side of this, right? It's, you know, it's a bunch of lawyers talking to a bunch of other lawyers. And as a lawyer, maybe I'm inclined to give that more importance than it deserves. That's a it would be a fair criticism. The other thing that, you know, as I looked at their founding documents, I looked at their introductory PR letter, and different folks have signed on to this organization in different capacities, right? So in other words, it's not as though all of these individuals believe, for example, that Trump has violated the Emoluments Clause. In fact, many of them do not, right? Hmm. So there isn't a single underlying principle other than the principle that there ought to be checks on the power of the executive. And I wonder if, right, I mean, keeping in mind that I believe that the foundational mission of the Federalist Society, and certainly its use over the past decade and a half, has been to radically increase the power of the executive, because structural conditions make it easier for those on the extreme right wing to elect presidents, who then have really huge, you know, outsized influence over judicial appointments. And, you know, and we've seen the Federalist Society go from playing a role in the George W. Bush administration to outright vetting, naming, and having 100% control over Trump's nominees in this administration. So, you know, so it is, in my view, an interesting development in terms of pushback, in terms of the narrative, in terms of, you know, the general principle that we've described as ascending Yodel Mountain, which is, are there hearts and minds left to be changed? And I think that this is a sign that there is.
Really grasping at straws there. Okay, well, all right, I guess I'll... You've been on a long, soothing vacation, so maybe you just... It's upped your optimism a little bit, so we'll let you. Just let him have it. Just don't. Yeah. Nobody say anything.
Well, if that felt optimistic to you, you're gonna love the next segment.
All right. Yeah, I'm curious. So again, as I said, you said on Twitter, and we have to get the explanation here. Of course, you always got to tune in to hear the full story. But you commented on Jeff Flake. I believe the news is he said he wouldn't vote for some judicial nominees unless this bill to protect Mueller got through the Senate. And I don't think it is. I think it already stalled out, didn't it? But you said this was actually a good sign. I'm curious. Why do you say that?
Yeah, so it's a good sign in the same vein as the last conversation that we had. So what happened? Outgoing, retiring Arizona Senator Jeff Flake announced on the floor of the Senate his intent to introduce a bill to protect Mueller from firing. The way in which origination legislation works in the Senate is that any senator may introduce a bill provided that there is unanimous consent of the Senate. Other Otherwise, legislation has to be introduced by the majority leader. And Mitch McConnell objected, did not grant unanimous consent for this legislation to come to the floor. And so, that's bad, right? But
okay,
we,
good.
You know,
agreed
you don't,
that
our
that
listeners,
is bad.
Right? Of course, that's bad. But our listeners don't need us
there,
to tell us that.
And can I ask you, is there any semblance of a like actual justification for that that makes any sense? Like, what in the world, if you were to just put on your charity, you know, your what's the word I'm looking for? Your steel man boots and your charity pants, and tell me, Andrew Torres, is there any good reason why anybody could be against a bill to protect Mueller? Like, am I crazy? Isn't it just, no, we want Trump to be able to get away with stuff, so we're not going to protect Mueller. What could possibly be the rationale?
So I don't think you're crazy, and I don't think there is a steel man argument at this stage of the investigation. Obviously, there are arguments that both Democrats and Republicans have introduced over the years, you know, particularly after the independent counsel statute that many Democrats thought, you know, gave Ken Starr sort of, you know, unfettered discretion to go way off the rails. Right. I mean, like, there's a lot of language from Democrats about Ken Starr, and it's why the independent counsel statute was allowed to lapse. So, you know, we need to be careful saying there are zero arguments in the abstract. There are certainly zero arguments in the main with respect to Mueller. And the argument that McConnell has made is, well, I don't think Trump's going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, which is like saying, you know, I mean, literally, you could say that about any law.
Yeah.
Right?
We don't need a like, law against murder. I don't think anybody's
right.
ever going to.
Yeah, why would anybody do that? Right?
Let's wait till somebody murders somebody and then we'll not do anything about it.
Right.
Is what
yeah.
I think.
No,
the answer
it's I think McConnell knows. Look, like if you want the argument for elections have no consequences and, you know, the other side is evil and mercenary and will just do whatever they want regardless. Right. Like you Mitch McConnell's a pretty good argument for that. Right. I mean, like he engineered yeah. stealing a Supreme Court seat and got away with it.
And then decided to pen a column saying, can't we all just get along, essentially?
Right. Yeah, no, it look, Mitch McConnell, again, you know, we've got to load up the high capacity magazine, you know, in going back through time with our sniper rifle. But like Mitch McConnell's got to be on that list, too.
Yeah.
And I should add, as a lawyer, right, that previous sentence involved a time machine. No one here on opening arguments is or should be read as calling for the assassination of anyone. Let's remove the rifle and say we go back in time and distribute birth control to, you know, like Hitler's
Ooh,
parents
a,
and Mitch McConnell's
good.
Parents. And
I like it. Yeah. It's kind of a peaceful yeah. alternative. Why does yeah. it always have to be baby murder? Why can't it just be a little preventative?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be Planned Parenthood.
We'll family
through time,
planning.
So.
That's all. A little family
right.
to benefit all of the planet. Okay.
That's
that
it. We need to get our Wiki and Mod Squad teams on creating a graphic that mashes up the Planned Parenthood logo with the Back to the Future logo. And that's what we're doing. Right. McConnell is partisan and evil and terrible. And we knew that. And nobody needs to know that. Nobody needs to be told that. I think this was really significant for a couple of reasons. Right. So, number one, you and I criticized Jeff Flake during the Kavanaugh nominations
yeah.
for moralizing, but then, you know, when it comes down to it, voting for him, right? This is, as far as I can tell, and the same thing, right? He agonized over the tax bill and then voted for it, right? This is the first time he actually was willing to vote. That's sort of point number one.
Well, we'll see.
Right. And 1A was multiple. Right. Lindsey Graham came out. This was, I mean, you know, you made this comment. I retweeted it out, you know, before the election that that folks like Lindsey Graham, who, you know, are the definition of politicians who twist in the wind, will reverse in the event that that there is a blue wave. And the fact that the first public thing Lindsey Graham has said after, you know, fulminating like a crazy person in favor of Brett Kavanaugh was, yeah, I'm in favor of a statute to protect Mueller. I think that's a validation of what you said. That's a Thomas was right.
Oh, well, thank you.
And yeah,
I don't know how right about that I was. I predicted that. Well, I mean, of course, that in my mind, I was hoping that also included, you know, Senator Beto O'Rourke or something. A little bit better of a blue result, but that's okay. I feel like that really would have changed Lindsey Graham a little bit, because, but that's neither here nor there. Okay, I take your, so the reason this is good news is because you think this is a sign that some Republicans are realizing that they're maybe in jeopardy because we can vote.
Yeah, because at the end of the day in 2020, right, the question for these Republicans is and will be, do I face more political liability in the primary, or, you know, if you're in a deep red state, from being aligned, you know, from being anti-Trump, or do I face it in the general election from being pro-Trump? And South Carolina, right, again, is a changing state. And, you know, Lindsey Graham is up for re-election in 2020. It's an R plus 15 state right now. So, you know, we know that that blue wave needs to get higher to wash over Lindsey Graham. It strikes me as not impossible that it will. So there is that. And secondly, and really this is, you know, you already alluded to it. Flake saying that he will not vote for lame duck, appointments to the judiciary is really, really significant, because that brings us down to 50-50. That means that all that needs to be done with any Trump judicial appointee is to pick off, you know, a Lisa Murkowski, a John Kennedy from Louisiana, who was the driving force that got Matthew Peterson's judicial nomination withdrawn. That was the guy who, you know, couldn't define what a motion in limine was. It makes it look. We see what Trump is doing right now. It makes it harder for him to cram through a bunch of stuff before the next Congress is sworn in January of 2019. And, you know, even if there isn't a vote on that, that sends a real signal. And there's nothing Trump can do to Flake right now.
This bill isn't going through, right?
No, I agree with that, but it is absolutely a different scenario to signal to Trump regarding, you know, his efforts, right? Like at this point, you know, we've already talked about, we're going to talk more about Whitaker and the Mueller probe in the main segment. The question is, what if Trump directs Whitaker to fire Mueller and suppress the report and stop the investigation? And like the question is, what will that backlash be? And I think the fact that the very first thing that the Republican Senate tried to do in the wake of the elections was protect Mueller is a pretty strong indication that that would still be viewed as Saturday Night Massacre too.
All right.
I'm an optimist, and I think there are good reasons to be an optimist.
Okay, and Whitaker to undergo recusal review by DOJ. I'm very curious about this, because I believe I asked you, like, can't they just say, recuse yourself? And he just says no, or is that wrong, still right? What's the info on that?
No, that determination is now going to be in the hands of the Department of Justice. Matthew Whitaker has said that he will undergo the full recusal protocols. The DOJ's Office of Legal Counsel, which is led by Emmett Flood, appointed by President Trump, right, is has already said, and we're going to talk about this in the main segment, that Whitaker has the general authority to be appointed acting attorney general. But then there are specific protocols for whether he needs to recuse himself from the Russia investigation. And he said that he's going to undergo those protocols and that determination and leave it up to the DOJ to determine whether he needs to recuse himself. I want to urge some caution here because there are two ways in which that may come up a negative, right? So the first is that merely having statements as a private individual, right, which we have, right? We have his CNN article in which he said, I think the Mueller investigation has gone off the rails. That is not grounds for recusal. And we need to be really, really careful in arguing that it ought to be, because certainly one of the things that is true in the age of Trump is that longtime civil servants who are in positions of authority have kind of said off the clock, like, yeah, you know, Trump is a nightmare, right? Like, I mean, you remember, and we made fun of it, right? Like when Ruth Bader Ginsburg in October of 2016 said, I think she called Trump a clown, right? All of these, right wingers were fulminating and up in arms and go, well, she's got to recuse herself. That's just, you know, and what we said was no, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg is entitled to her private opinions as a private citizen regarding Donald Trump. This is particularly rich coming from the side of the aisle that allows Clarence Thomas to speak at whatever conservative crazy organization right. every 3 weeks. So number one, if all there is Whitaker's public statements in opposition to the Mueller probe, it would not surprise me if their findings were, yeah, we asked him about it, and he said that he will do the job impartially. And I know that's going to rankle people. It may be warranted in this case, but we need to be consistent about that. There may be deeper connections, right? And he's going to have to disclose those, or alternatively, he could lie to the DOJ. Right. Which, look, if he lies, right, that those are really, really good grounds for impeachment or for removal. So I don't want to suggest. I think the most likely outcome is that he will pass the recusal process. But a week ago, I wasn't sure that he would voluntarily undergo it.
How could he pass the recusal just because of bias? I mean, like he had meetings. First off, he's not qualified for this job. He's not. Well, OK, maybe that doesn't mean you have to recuse. I don't know. You don't think there would be a solid recusal case to be made?
I think there is a solid case to be made. I think there is a not insignificant chance that that the recommendation will come down for recusal. I just want us to be prepared if it goes the other way, because I think there is a not insubstantial case the other way, because recusal is a high bar to meet, and we want it to be that way, is I guess my continued point here, right? We do not want, I mean, think back to, you know, when we were going through
I don't know, but we want it to be so high that a guy who like is going on TV and saying this investigation's fake, here's how you dispose of this investigation. Step one, you do this, and then gets appointed to the job in charge of the investigation. You don't think that's recusal worthy?
I think that it is recusal worthy. I just am pointing out that if it goes the other way, it does not necessarily mean, you know, that the fix is in. And the positive step is that process is underway. And obviously, we're going to talk about the lawsuit in a minute. So there we go.
Hey, listeners, you know me. I love learning, and I imagine you're the same because you're listening to this show. We learn so much from Andrew each and every episode. And that's why I'm such a big fan of the Great Courses Plus streaming service. I mentioned before, I've been using the Great Courses since long before this show. I love them. Watching and listening to these award-winning experts explore fascinating people, places, and ideas is so much fun. With unlimited access to thousands of lectures, also, you've always got something new to explore. In particular, I've mentioned I've also been enjoying this course, The Great Trials of World History. It's so apropos to opening arguments. I just checked out the conspiracy trial for the conspiracy to kill Abraham Lincoln. It's really interesting. Of course, we all remember John Wilkes Booth and all that. But what I only vaguely remember from, I think, eighth grade was the fact that this was actually part of a large conspiracy. Eight people would be tried for conspiracy to murder the president and other officials. And you can join this professor for a look at the verdicts, the sentences, and the procedures of the 1865 Military Commission. So another example of a fantastic lecture from a very fascinating course over on the Great Courses Plus. They want you to start enjoying the Great Courses Plus too, so they're giving our listeners a fantastic limited time offer. You get your first month for free, plus receive the second month for only 99 cents. That's unlimited access to enjoy their huge library of engaging lectures for two full months for under a dollar. And that's the whole library. By the way, maybe you're thinking, oh, Thomas, I don't really care about that particular trial and lecture. That's fine. You get unlimited access. There are so many courses, anything you want to learn, it's there. And you can enjoy two full months for 99 cents. However, to get this exclusive offer, you must sign up through our URL within the next couple weeks. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. Remember, this special offer to get the first month free and the second month for just 99 cents is only available for a limited time and only by using the URL thegreatcoursesplus.com/OA. That's OA for opening arguments. And Kyrsten Sinema wins Arizona. Was there something right or wrong on that you said?
Oh, I was, well, that's where I was wrong because, as you pointed out at the intro to this segment, the distinction between uncounted votes and recounts is a significant one that we've always tried to maintain. I said in the last episode, I did not think Sinema was going to overtake Marcia McSally in Arizona. She did. She has now... One, she has not been certified by the Arizona Secretary of State, but her opponent has conceded, and she is up by over a percentage point now, by 38,000 votes out of 2 million that have been cast. She won Arizona. That is a great result, and I want you to remember that that's a great result because Kyrsten Sinema is about to rank right up there with Joe Manchin as... if you are a liberal Democrat as your most hated Democratic senator. Look, that's coming. She is a blue dog Democrat. And it is particularly galling to a lot of liberals. I mean, we talked about this. The Green Party candidate in that race withdrew a month ago and got 50,000 votes. you know, this could have been a 4-point blowout. Right. But people on the left are really, really mad at Kyrsten Sinema, and they're mad at her because she sort of looks like a hippie granola lefty coming up. Right. Like she voted for Nader. She worked for Nader in 2000. She was a member of the Green Party. She self-identifies as bisexual. She self-identified as being atheist. And then, you know, she got into Congress and joined the Blue Dog Coalition. She's the sixth most conservative Democratic member of the House of Representatives. So, you know, it kind of looks like she's got this profile of we thought she was going to be more liberal than this. She's not, right? She is a centrist conservative Democrat. And it's much better to have a centrist Democrat as senator from Arizona than to have a right-wing Trump ally.
Yeah.
And it is super significant. As far as I can tell, right, every place that was a close race where Trump did last-minute rallies with Republican supporters. I mean, you know, we sort of talked about this in the is there a shy Trump voter, you know, kind of anti-Bradley effect. Trump looks like he carried an awful lot, right? DeSantis in Florida, certainly in Georgia, in Indiana. Trump appeared at a rally with McSally right before the Arizona election, and as far as I know, and there were a couple of polls right up until the day of election that showed late movement to McSally. If this race followed the pattern of other states, particularly in the Senate, you would have expected it to go the other way. And Sinema pulled it off. And, you know, I get it. It's terrible to, you know, and when she votes with Trump on thing, like, it's going to be frustrating. But remember that it could have been much, much worse.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there are a lot of people on the left who don't see it that way, I think. But I just think it is objectively better to have one more vote against healthcare repeal or one more vote against a horrendous tax bill or what, you know, it just is objectively better than not having that. And while there are a lot of people who call themselves Democrats who obviously are to the right of you or I, it's better to have that than a 100% Trump voter. I mean, it just is. It's just better outcomes. I know it doesn't feel great, but I agree with you on that. All right, time to get to our main segment. Hey, listeners, you know what's not smart? Job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through. That's not smart. Hey, you know, oh my gosh, from my personal experience, back when I used to work for the state, we'd have to go through this very thing. Whenever we were hiring, you'd get a whole bunch of resumes and packets that were just people clicked on all of the available entries for where they were trying to apply. And so you'd get just a load of nonsense applications and resumes from people who had no business applying and just because they clicked a button. That's not smart. You know what is smart though? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/OA to hire the right person. Oh my gosh, I wish we could have done this back at the state. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. You know, hiring someone is a major decision, and you do not want to be stuck with a pool of candidates who you don't like, who aren't quite right for the job. Then you feel pressure to go with one. If it's the wrong candidate, then you're stuck with that person for so long. It is not worth it. Use ZipRecruiter. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. That's ZipRecruiter.com/OA for opening arguments. One last time, ZipRecruiter.com/OA. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Andrew, what's going on with this lawsuit over Whitaker? I'm really, really curious about this. You've already teased it quite a bit, so spill the beans.
Yeah, and let me cut to the punchline, which is that there has been an order issued by the United States District Court for the District of Maryland. I will upload it in the show notes, and it is to say that the district court for the District of Maryland will issue a legal determination on who the next attorney general is. And that is going to come, that hearing will be December 19th, 2018. Okay. So 1 month and 4 days from now. How did we get there? we got there, and this is being reported everywhere as Maryland sued over the next attorney general. This is another lawsuit brought by my buddy Brian Frosch, attorney general of the state of Maryland, and somebody who, boy, we should be talking about as an up and coming hero in the Democratic Party. It's not correct that Maryland filed a new lawsuit regarding the appointment of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general. What he did is something really, really clever. And you may recall that in our last episode, when I was talking about the appointment of Whitaker, I said I believed that Robert Mueller, for example, could have standing to challenge Whitaker's appointments under the Vacancies and Reform Act. And you asked the question, well, who else might have standing? And you know, we sort of pontificated about it. Here's how Maryland came up with standing to challenge the appointment of Whitaker as acting attorney general. This is really, really clever. And it makes me suspect that Brian Frosch is either an opening arguments listener, which could be. Hi, Brian. Or is just a really, really smart lawyer, which is obviously, you know, a much higher probability outcome. Maryland had previously filed an existing lawsuit naming Jeff Sessions, naming the Department of Justice. They'd filed that lawsuit on September 13th of 2018. And that's actually something, it's on our whiteboard to do a deep dive. It challenges the December 2017 tax bill, which, as you pointed out, eliminates the penalty for the individual mandate under the ACA.
Wait a minute. Has it been a year since we did that? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Crazy.
And so the lawsuit, which has been joined by numerous states, says that you cannot use, as part of the reconciliation process, as part of the tax bill process, something that repeals the core mandate of the ACA, right? Mm-hmm. That's pending. And Maryland is a party to that lawsuit. They brought a separate lawsuit against Jeff Sessions after Sessions said that he would not defend the constitutionality of the individual mandate in court, right? And so the lawsuit was designed to compel the government to defend the constitutionality of the existing ACA. Now, with the change in the Attorney General, Maryland's argument is, hey, we need to know who the Attorney General is, whether the acting Attorney General is Matt Whitaker or whether it's Rod Rosenstein, in order to determine whether we can go ahead with this lawsuit.
Ooh,
right?
Savvy.
Because if the new Attorney General intends to defend the ACA, well, then we don't need to move to compel him to defend the ACA. And in fact, likely because of past statements by Whitaker on the record where he thinks that the ACA is, you know, the worst legislation. I mean, we've both read that interview in which, you know, he decried Marbury versus Madison as being wrongly decided and said, you know, there's an uninterrupted string of, you know, Congress exceeding its authorities under the Commerce Clause that includes the individual mandate of the ACA. Well, that's cited in this case, right? So it says, look, we have a real and justiciable controversy. We have a real interest in knowing who the Attorney General is.
Yeah.
So they've brought this lawsuit, and the lawsuit tracks what we said last week in terms of challenging Whitaker's appointment. Specifically, it makes two arguments, and I want to go through kind of the nuances of the argument because I think this is really interesting, and I think that this forms a case where you might, well, let's see what you think about it when we get through it. So the first argument is that the Vacancies and Reform Act does not supersede the Attorney General Succession Act, right, which is a more specific statute that says exactly who's in the line of succession for Attorney General. That Attorney General Succession Act, by the way, that's what I relied upon in our G. Zachary Terwilliger.
Poor guy.
Right.
Man.
Yeah, no,
he's just Zachary Twilliger. You just see a cut to him. He's just like, ah, shucks. He has some old timey.
I kind of picture him as Gil from The Simpsons. Dag
nabbit.
Right? Like, oh, old G. Zachary Twilliger.
All I know is that G. Zachary Twilliger can never get a fair shake in this thing.
I like to think that he's, you know, because if I were G. Zachary Terwilliger, I would have a Google alert set up on my own.
I picture him in the Department of Justice with like overalls and a, you know, the what's the thing they always have in their mouths with the
Oh, like a sprig, like a stalk of hay or
what
something.
What is that? Has anyone ever asked, like, why are you doing that? Are you getting nutrition from that thing, or is it just part of the overall look? Anyway, okay, go on. Back to the...
Okay. So, so the argument is that the Vacancies and Reform Act applies to over 1,000 different potential vacancies, potential different executive agencies, and the Attorney General Succession Act applies to one, right? And one super important office because it's in the line of presidential succession, right? And so relying on that, the argument advanced by the state of Maryland is that the Vacancies and Reform Act, 5 USC, and in particular the subsection 3347A1, provides that it does not provide for the Vacancies and Reform Act does not provide for the exclusive method of determining the succession of officials if, quote, another statutory provision expressly designates an officer or employee to perform the functions and duties of a specified office temporarily in an acting capacity, which the Attorney General Succession Act does. Now, the argument in response to this, we actually covered in a previous episode. So I don't know if you remember it. There was also a hint in the way in which I just described it. You want to take a stab at it, or you want me to just go ahead? Okay. it is sure... The Vacancies and Reform Act says that it is not the exclusive means of determining the successor, but it can be a concurrent means. And in fact, when we discussed the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and the lawsuit brought by Leandra English, that was exactly the same argument that was raised in the CFPB case, right? It said, look, the CFPB was created by statute. It provides that the deputy director succeeds to the directorship in the event of a vacancy. That then should trump the Vacancies and Reform Act. And the district court in that case said, no, what the Vacancies and Reform Act says is that it can, that the president then can elect either to allow a natural successor to come to the fore, or may use the Vacancies and Reform Act to appoint someone else. And there are reasons why the president might not choose to exercise the VRA. For example, one of the restrictions of the VRA is that the person who is named acting to the office that is vacant cannot then be subsequently appointed to permanently fill the position, right? So you might not want, as the president, to exercise the VRA.
So was that powers. To try you to get around this one weird trick to get whoever you want in without... any sort of approval? Okay.
Right. Exactly right. So, and I have to tell you that as a baseline, that's a pretty good argument. I mean, it's a really good argument because it won in the CFPB case, right? The state of Maryland's argument here is a little bit more nuanced. And again, I think it illustrates the interesting position that we're in. It says, sure, that's true for the CFPB, because the CFPB is an office in which the director selects his or her own deputy director, right? But here, we're dealing with the Office of Attorney General, in which the position of Assistant Attorney General is also constitutionally mandated to be selected with the advice and consent of the Senate. So in other words, this argument is the Appointments Clause argument, right? And it says, look, we know that the Attorney General is a really, really important position, right? It's in line for succession to the presidency. The Attorney General can only be appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate. And it's so important that the statute that provides for who gets to take over for being Attorney General in the event of a vacancy, that Assistant Attorney General must be appointed with the advice and consent of the Senate, which, by the way, the Senate has consented to the appointment of Rod Rosenstein. But here, Matthew Whitaker has not been confirmed by the Senate to anything. And so the argument is that in this particular case, that it would bypass not only the intent of the statute, but also conflict with the Constitution itself, right? Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2, that says principal officers nominated by the president must be appointed, quote, with the advice and consent of the Senate. And so you are not just dealing with conflicting statutory interpretations, but you would be violating the Constitution itself to essentially install somebody who has not been appointed and had not been confirmed by the Senate an office that requires that. Go ahead.
But can you tell me then how I think I see the argument? This is pretty pretty complex stuff. I'm not sure how you imagine that I would possibly be able to come up with this on my own. But anyway, how does this potentially violate the Constitution in a way that the other, like the CFPB situation, doesn't? Like, if the Constitution says anyone appointed to these positions has to be vetted by Congress, essentially, but it's okay statutorily in some situations, but not in others, I guess I don't see why it would be unconstitutional here and not everywhere.
And that's exactly right. It is that there's a Supreme Court case, United States versus Eaton. It's from 1898. And what it says is a temporary appointment to fulfill one of these principal offices, right, like attorney general, can be made and can be filled even by an individual who has not been confirmed by the Senate in cases of, quote, an exigency, that is an emergency, quote, for a limited time under special and temporary conditions, end of quote. And so
the statute had to use that as the rationale when they passed them, I'm guessing.
That's exactly right. Okay. And that's where the argument is going to come down to, which is, okay, in the CFPB, Mick Mulvaney, I should add, Mick Mulvaney was confirmed by the Senate, right? So in other words, there was not the same crisis that is presented here, right? Now, Mick Mulvaney could have been in a different position under the VRA, right? But this precise conflict was not present in the CFPB case because Mulvaney had previously been confirmed by the Senate. Courts never faced this particular issue. But the logic being used, right, the logic that says the president can opt either for the VRA or for the statutory provisions of succession by statute would apply with equal force here, right? So it's important to tackle the argument. And that's exactly what the Trump administration is going to argue in response. They're going to say, yeah, right, we could not appoint an attorney general who has not been confirmed by the Senate, but we can get Whitaker in there without having to get confirmed by the Senate because he's only going to take over in a temporary basis. And Frosch is aware of this and has blocked out in their brief my argument, right? Which is
your argument.
Sure,
wow.
My argument. I'm going to read it word for word. There is no such emergency in this case, not even close. Here, the, quote, vacancy, end quote, is one for which the president himself is responsible. He asked then Attorney General Sessions to resign and no doubt would have fired him had Sessions refused.
Okay, I was curious if they were going to be able to use those facts, because I thought the BS cover story was going to be like, well, no, I didn't ask him to he resigned and now we have a vacancy and there's nothing we can do about it. What facts are they going to be able to use to say, no, he actually asked for it? Are they going to be able to point to like New York Times reporting or something?
Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, if this case goes right, because remember, this is just a lawsuit, right? Seeking a declaratory judgment. If this case goes forward on the merits, they'll be able to seek discovery on this point. This is really, really clever, the way this is phrased, because I frame the argument. It's phrased, by the way, more intelligently than I framed the argument last week.
I won't
because
hear it.
I said, yeah, the argument will come down to, you know, was he fired or, you know, did he resign? And the position that Attorney General Frosch has taken is, look, it doesn't matter whether they call it fired or resigned. Mm. The issue is there's no emergency because the vacancy was created by the president himself. And so I don't care what they call it. I care that there was not an emergency as we have understood that to mean since 1898. And that's a really, really good argument.
Okay.
And so that's kind of the first area in which this argument is going to come down to. It's going to come down to United States versus Eaton. Is there an exigency? Is there an emergency that allows the president to fulfill a principal office with a non-principal officer on an emergency basis, right? And does this count as, quote, special and temporary conditions of exigency? That's going to be really, really interesting. There's a second argument that Maryland has made that we have not previously flagged. That is another really interesting argument. And that argument involves the canon of constitutional avoidance. So, canon of constitutional avoidance. So, what does that mean? That means that ordinarily a court is to construe whether a statute can be interpreted, if a statute is ambiguous, whether it is fair to interpret that statute in such a way as to avoid potential conflicts with constitutional provisions, right? So let me unpack that for a second. As a general principle, right, that makes a lot of sense. And what that means is that if you pass a law that says, let's say it says a law that says you must get a license for your business, right? And then as a result of having passed that law, it could be interpreted as saying, oh, look, like reporters have to go get licensed before they can print a story, right? Suppose that they were just really, really careless in doing so, right? Then what the courts would say is rather than rule on the First Amendment constitutionality of whether you can license journalists, if the statute was ambiguous, we're just going to read an exception for journalists into that statute, right? The idea is sort of, look, if the legislators were careless, if they left it ambiguous, then we'd rather not have to decide constitutional questions than decide them, right? That's kind of a general principle of jurisprudence. If in doubt, let's not ask courts to opine on what the Constitution means. Let's save it for serious constitutional questions, right? And so as a general principle, that makes a lot of sense. And what Maryland is arguing here is that the standard for invoking the canon of constitutional avoidance is not that you have to show definitely that the defendant's reading of the statute would violate the Constitution, but that you just have to show that it is, quote, a serious, end quote, constitutional question, problem, or doubt, that the reading is, quote, plausible or fairly possible. And so their argument is, let's see if I can put this all together. Look, judge, if you think that it is possible that this reading, allowing the Vacancy Reform Act to put someone into place to act as acting attorney general in who has not been confirmed by the Senate, would violate the Appointments Clause of the Constitution. If you think that's even a plausible argument, then you have to defer to an interpretation of the statute that says, no, obviously the statute's not meant to allow you to trump something like the Attorney General statute. It's a super interesting argument, and it's a really good way to kind of avoid having to dig into the merits of the specific case. And as a 1-2 punch that kind of leads off with, by the way, we think this appointment looks really, really fishy, and the vacancy was created by the president. And here's a way that you don't have to dig into those facts, that you can just say, as a matter of judicial interpretation, I am required to construe that this statute is not concurrent with a specific statute like the Attorney General Succession Act. That may be really, really tempting. I want to. So those are the two arguments. I want to conclude with, this is pending before Judge Ellen Hollander. This is a judge in front of whom I have argued. Not somebody that is a friend, but somebody
you're
who's
all
a colleague,
over this
somebody
story.
I
you
know.
Get the arguments. Oh, man. You've argued in front of the. This is you're everywhere in this.
Yeah, Judge Hollander was formerly on the Maryland Court of Special Appeals. That is our intermediate appellate court. And I've had multiple arguments in front of her. She's a friend of several of my ex-partners. She was appointed to fill one of my judicial heroes, Andre Davis's seat on the U.S. District Court for the District of Maryland when Judge Davis was elevated to the Fourth Circuit. So she is very, very smart, and she loves kind of digging into minutia like this. I have a tremendous amount of respect. So I am super excited about how this lawsuit is going to go forward. The government's response is due December 3rd. Amicus briefs are due November 26th. So I'm actually talking to a couple of people. I can't reveal anything. I have talked to two separate legal groups. And if we get the opportunity to participate as amicus, I will obviously share
Wait,
that on
first
the show. I'll have
ever
to stop.
Opening arguments amicus brief.
So I will keep everyone posted on that, but amicus briefs are due in 11 days. The government's response is due December 3rd. I will be tracking this with tremendous interest. Look, we know what the government's response is going to look like. It's going to look like the Office of Legal Counsel memorandum written by Emmett Flood. I'm going to link that in the show notes. But how they tackle some of these specific arguments is going to be really, really interesting. And I think I'll leave you with that.
All right. Wow. Action packed as usual. We definitely didn't have the amount of time you thought, but I'm looking forward to the thrilling conclusion of that one. So we've got to do, this is a 1 minute segment, California wildfires. What do you have to say? You typed in here 1 minute segment. I'm curious. Let's start the clock,
yep.
Everybody.
Yep.
Let's see.
Okay, start the clock. So I'm going to link this in the show notes. PG&E is a publicly traded utility. As a result, they are required to issue what are known as Form 8K disclosures. Those are mandated to the Securities and Exchange Commission. They must be filed within 4 days of, quote, a current event, which is defined through the case law and through the statute as something of which your shareholders must be advised that, you know, can then be used to take into account in determining at what price to buy and sell the stock. They filed on November 9th a Form 8K that says on November 8th, a wildfire began near the city of Paradise, California. Yeah. So this is the fire that is by you, Thomas. So yeah. Opportunity, by the way, we should take this off my clock right now. But how are you doing?
I'm fine. I just, you know, can't go outside. It's a hellscape out here. It's horrific. But anyway, I saw in the news that as a result of this filing where they said, hey, we might have caused this, the stock went down like 50% or something. Like it's just all totally crumbled.
Yeah. And rightly so. It says that they are announcing the campfire. The campfire, they say the cause of the campfire is under investigation. However, we submitted an electric incident report to the California Public Utilities Commission that on November 8th at 0615 hours, which is literally right before the fire began, PG&E experienced an outage on the Caribou Palermo 115 kilovolt transmission line in Butte County, and then observed via aerial patrol approximately 1 mile northeast the downed tower in the area of the campfire. So the fact that they disclosed that to their shareholders means that there is an internal determination that maybe PG&E that possibly PG&E is the cause of that fire. If PG&E is the cause of that fire, that will mean that their insurance policy, which covers events like this, their primary insurance policy will trigger an exclusion for acts that are intended or expected from the standpoint of the insured, meaning that they will have no insurance coverage for liabilities.
Well, the thing is that when I first, because I read that same thing, and now that you say it was a disclosure that, you know, they, it sounds like it's likely they are to blame if they made a disclosure that cut their stock price in half. I don't think they would have just done that casually. But when I first read it and I didn't know any of that, I thought that just sounded like, oh, we're reporting a tower is down, like maybe a car ran into something, or, you know, I didn't know that that necessarily meant it was their fault. You know, could it still just be that they knew about it and there was an outage, but it doesn't mean they necessarily caused it through some, you know, negligent action or something.
Yeah, and what that means is they have not made an internal determination that it is their fault, but it means that at some point there is internal discussion that maybe this downed line is what caused the spark that caused the fire. And if it could be shown that they knew about that, and so clearly what happened is some risk adjustment, again, we don't have these documents yet, but somebody somewhere in PG&E sent an email that said, oh, hey, look, like, we reported this outage and then the fire started. Was that our line that caused that? And once you know, if they fail to disclose that within 4 days, then they are, in addition to everything else, potentially liable for SEC violations. Those could be criminal violations.
So that's right? Why you're so saying they disclosed it before they even knew.
That's why they disclosed, okay, right, before they've made an official determination.
So honestly, I mean, I don't know, but it could end up that they are really get screwed over this. Like, it could end up that it wasn't really their fault and their share price tanked 50%. You know, I mean, I don't know, but couldn't that be true?
That absolutely could be true. And so it's why I thought it was worth covering on the show. And it's one of
I'm
those.
I'm glad we took
you know,
that 60 seconds to discuss this.
Yes, of course. There we go. Let's go off the clock.
All right. It is time for our co-favorite segment of the week. So glad to be doing this. Thanking our top patrons at patreon.com/law. And I'm sure you have to look forward to a very juicy, long, amazing, lot awful movies coming this month for you, since we were gone and couldn't work it out during Andrew's infinite vacation. So we'll make sure to come back at you with something great. So make sure to jump on that. We also still got you the Q&A, and there's always bonus stuff happening. So patreon.com/law. Here's our top patrons. We begin with happy 12th birthday to Cap, our border collie dog. Oh, that's fantastic. I love it. Wishing a dog a happy birthday is a great use of your patron name. Good stuff.
Absolutely.
McKinney ISD is run by bigoted dominionists. Sort of a different message from the first one. Gee Willikers, Matt Whitaker. This is a good one. Gee Willikers, Matt Whitaker, Hornswaggle, G. Zachary Terwilliger. That's awesome. Mistellan Company, civilpoliticsradio.com, Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Valley Free Radio. The Registry Matters podcast. Zabby, Abacus Finch, Sessions is an unattractive distractor. Glory, glory, hole, Illuya. Advocate for a foster child in your community. CASAforChildren.org.
Oh, CASA is a fantastic organization, so I'm glad they're using that.
Great. How much damage can the GOP do in the lame duck session? We'll see. Brian Studwell. Thomas Smith is my favorite attorney. Andrew's a close second. James Dr. No from Russia with love, Goldfinger, Thunderball, you only live...
Is it just all the James Bond movies?
Yeah. Blank Boxman. You needed worthy opponents. Interesting. Kurt Robinson. Cosmo, the karaoke legend, formerly known as Pete Barrington. SF adopted a homelessness funding measure and opposed corporate BS. Ooh, nice. That was a good complex correlation of a California ballot measure, or a San Francisco ballot measure, and a previous patron name. That's a good one. Poseidon is 9/10 of maritime law. Kiowa Valley exports for Australian red meat and craft beer. Yodely McYodelface. There are very fine people on both sides of TTTBE gate. Hey, baby, are you a footnote? What? Hey, baby, are you footnote 4 of Caroline products? Is that the start of a joke?
Oh, that is exceptional. No, that's a great reference. So I'll read that one next week.
Okay.
So yeah, it's too long for us to do here in the TTTB segment.
Sam Buck, the other Michael Cohen, Milo Mead song, the Halfling Bard, and SIU3L, the Getting Off podcast. Join your labor union. Together we bargain. Alone we beg. Amazon Alexa, order 1,000 avocados. Uh-oh. Capes off for Stan Lee. Starry Decisis from the Top Rope, brother. Truck Fump. Mike the Intactivist. James sure hopes that elections have consequences. They do, definitely. Rob Shrek. Dalen Lee Samus Grix. Brian Upshaw's Last Chance For-Profit Prison. Japan Dan. Buttercup the Cat. Official TTTBE Gate Council to Thomas Smith. Anonymous, biggest blue wave since Nixon. Can we not downplay it and feed the right-wing narrative, please? Yes, absolutely. Attorney Doll Relationship, Saudi Arabia Assassinations and More LLC, and Squint Finger.
All right, and thank you to Vote Democratically for a Democrat to Preserve Democracy. Join me. Give more to podcasters in December or January. Happy holidays. Great message. Eastern District Crunchwrap Supreme Court. Oh, that still sounds so good. If a non-top patron changes their name, does it still make a sound? That's a great philosophical question there.
Ouch.
Wigged Hitch Runt. F Patreon for insisting on adding a county in my profile. Yeah, we got a lot of complaints about that. That's county? Not our policy.
It must
you
be
know.
Country. There's no way that... Do they ask you for a county?
I don't know. I've been signed
this
up for Patreon for years.
This person is from the UK. I can see it in their email. So it must mean country. Right?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking maybe it means county, and that's why they're upset about it. Right?
Oh, okay. I thought it was going to be like one of that tax. What's that, you know, like they wanted to avoid the VAT or what? No, what is it? The VAT tax that, anyway, okay. Different, we keep going.
Who knows? Let us know, top patron. Yeah. WordOrigins.org, your guide to legal terms from 13th century Saxony. Mighty Muller's Power Ranger. What's a better Yodelbots villain, Decepti-Trumps or De-Trumpticons? I think I've already weighed in on that one. Tie me kangaroo down, sport. That's exceptional. And hopefully you'll take my best Steve Irwin impersonation there. I went to Steve Irwin's zoo, by the way. It was amazing.
Oh, nice.
Saul, a synonym of Spiro Agnew is Pyro Agnew. Jeremiah has internalized that the Brewers won their division. Yeah, but you know, it's time to move on now. We're in free agency. Big Easy Blasphemy, a string of unpronounceable characters, large and in charge, chunky yet funky, hashtag Team Latrice. I don't know who that is, but you know, it is what it is. TTTB was a fraud. My first witness is Andrew's guilty conscience. Legalize the Purge, Brandon Smith. I would donate more, but it's raining outside. Thomas is wrong. Infinity War is an awesome movie. There you go. Good use of your thing there. I have Infinity War thoughts that I will share with our patrons. So how about that? Rhonda, the Rigged Witch Hunter, Malika Chandler, Abacus Flinch, Soggy Pants, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org, CampQuest.org. I can't believe it's a law firm. Nice Lionel Hutz reference. We're overdue for one of those. Sam Danow, Greg Sullivan. Remember that time Catholics tried to blow up the government?
Yep.
Adopt a homeless pet and oppose declawing and ear docking. Matthew Vernon, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Aaron Grady. If only keeping children with their parents was as popular as weed. Yeah. Ian and Alley, St. Muller, patron saint of yodelers, Sakashite Fukusumi, illegitimi non carborundorum, and yes, we'll read that one because it's in Latin. Jim Grove, Eli Bosnick, Mitchell, Wobblers, Bobblers, and Wicked Knob Gobblers, LLP. Be a patron of philosophers in space to hear Thomas ruin movies. That's fair. Opening Arguments Caravan, invading your country, nunc pro tunc. Mormon J. Fox. And our top patron, our unbeatable champion, but you should still try, Conrad Michaels. Thank you all so much. We have a lot of fun with the segment, but we sincerely thank all of you for sponsoring the show here over at patreon.com/law. This is a tremendous support, and it helps us do the show. And thank you all. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
All right. I think it's time to try to get back on the saddle. And, you know, dust myself off after a disappointing 100th question, which I should have gotten right. But, all right, 59 for 100. How about it? TTGB number 101.
All right, Thomas. Well, as you heard, our winner requested a space law question. I am digging up a bona fide space law question. I will. It's going to be TTTB 102. It will not be 101 because
it's got to
literally
be like a real question, though, right?
Yeah, it's got to. No, seriously, it's a real
question. You know what you could have done is just change the wording, like the names, you know, in the.
Well, let's try it. Here we go. Okay.
Yeah. An Ewok.
Yes. An Ewok owed Lando Calrissian $1,500. The space statute of limitations barred recovery on that claim. The debtor, Ewok, wrote to the lender, Lando Calrissian, stating, "I promise to pay you $500 if you will extinguish the debt." The lender agreed. Wow. Is the debtor's promise, the Ewok's promise, to pay Lando Calrissian $500 enforceable?
Ooh, A, really tough space law question.
Yeah, right. A, no, because the debtor Ewok made no promise not to plead the statute of limitations as a defense.
Huh.
B, no, because there was no consideration for the debtor's promise. C, yes, because the debtor's promise provided a benefit to the lender. Or D, yes, because the debtor's promise to pay part of the barred antecedent debt needs no consideration to be enforceable.
Well, all right, I'm combing through my extensive knowledge of space law that I feel like I know space law more than regular law just from watching Star Wars or something. I don't know. I watched it a lot. Let me think back to Emperor Strikes Back. Let's see. So if I remember right, Darth Vader can go back on any deal. He can modify a contract. You know, remember with Lando, Darth Vader could just modify all the contracts he wants. Maybe it's just might makes right in space law. No, okay, real question, contracts question. I think this is really interesting. So if an Ewok owes Lando $1,500, it says the Ewok owes $1,500, but the statute of limitations bars recovery on the claim. So that's interesting. I'm not sure how that exactly will pan out here because. Okay, so the debtor wrote to the Ewok wrote to Lando saying, "I will pay you $500 if you will extinguish the debt." And then Lando said, "Okay, I know good business dealing. Two things I know, Lando Calrissian, space mining and good deals, except when it comes to Darth Vader." So he said, "Okay, sure." So now it's asking, is the Ewok promising to pay Lando $500 enforceable? That's very interesting. So what I imagine the key question is going to be, because we know, I've learned from months of doing space law here, from years of doing space law with you, that you need consideration for the contract. You need like an agreement or something. I'm going to forget the exact wording, but you can't just agree. I can't just one-sidedly agree, "Hey, Andrew, I'll give you $500 if you... I don't know, do that Scientology thing where you clear my..." So just some fake thing. Like, there's got to be... You have to give up something, too, for it to be an actual contract, I believe. It can't just be, "I pay you $500 to do nothing, to mentally imagine something." So that's the question. Will the statute of limitations barring the recovery on that $1,500, does that mean extinguishing the debt is worthless? Is nothing? I don't know. I feel like I don't know. So let's go through the answers. No, because the debtor made no promise to not plead the statute of limitations as a defense. See, I don't think that's it, because the contract would be a separate thing regardless of that, I think. B, no, because there is no consideration for the debtor's promise. Okay, so that's the one that's jumping out to me as, if the statute of limitations barring recovery makes extinguishing the debt worthless, then it's B, I think. Let's go on, though. Yes, because the debtor's promise provided a benefit to the lender. The debtor's promise provide. See, that doesn't make sense. The debtor's promise to... that's going to be weird. I could maybe conceive of a way in that would be right, but it seems weird. D, yes, because the debtor's promise to pay part of the barred antecedent debt needs no consideration to be enforceable. See, that doesn't seem right. Well, shoot. Needs no consideration. I feel like it is consideration, though. Isn't extinguishing the debt consideration? And so, needs no consideration. Wow, this is actually really hard. I thought this was going to be an easier one, but it's not. or maybe I'm overthinking. I think B is a strong contender because, you know, essentially that means I'm paying you $500 for nothing. But D, I could see D being true if you're thinking like, well, you don't, if you promise to pay $500 on a debt. No, see, I don't think D's right because of the statute of limitations. So I'm going to go not D. C, I think it's B or C, maybe. No, B or D. I'm going with B. Screw it. I don't know. You know what? What do I have to prove? I failed at my 60% threshold on 100 questions. I'm going to go with B. I'm going to try not to overthink myself as I did in question 100. I'm going to say it's B. Final answer. It's either B or like probably B or D, maybe. So that second chance is B or D. Final answer, B.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas on this fabulous space contract law question, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include your answer. Include the hashtag TTTB. Include your reasons, therefore. And we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune.
Space credits.
Not guaranteed. Yes.
We'll shower them with
Federation
credits or something.
There we go.
What's the currency of the rebellion? They never really tell you that, do they?
They're a barter collective, right?
But I feel like it should be the Confederacy had their like fake money, you know, their kind of monopoly money they used. I feel like all rebellions usually invent their own currency, and it should be something with Leia's face on it, maybe. You know,
I agree.
We'll give you a bunch of that. All right. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Thanks for playing along. I know that was a convoluted answer. That was a tough question. I'm looking forward to the explanation on that. Maybe I was making it more complicated than it should have been. But thanks, Andrew. Glad you're back, even though sorry you're not on vacation anymore. But it's nice to be back to our regularly scheduled studio time. And looking forward to seeing you on Tuesday, everybody. We'll see you then.
You betray the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.
Opening Arguments is produced with the help of our editor, Brian Ziegenhagen, production assistant, Natalie Newell, and our unofficial researcher, Magpie. A special thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Natalie, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, and Emily Waters. And also thanks to Thomas Smith, who wrote and produced all of the amazing music you hear, which is used with his permission.
No, so yeah, like, look, so, right.